Good. Well, it was great fun talking yesterday, and I hope I can continue in the vein that I was using last time. So let me just review a few things about yesterday's lecture. So, as I mentioned, what I'm interested in doing is estimating, or I talk about upper and lower bounds, but let's just say, use the general word, estimating this quadratic form. A is a symmetric matrix again, and it's positive definite, and U is a given vector. And although everything I discuss is connected with being a finite dimensional problem, it extends to more general situations. And then the idea was that I took this quadratic form, f is some analytic function, and then I write that as in terms of its eigenvalues and Fourier coefficients after diagonalizing A in this fashion here, and I say this sum is an integral f of lambda d alpha of lambda. Okay, and then if I have an integral, then I'm going to approximate that integral, that's what I of f is, plus I have a remainder term, and I discuss using Gauss quadrature for computing the integral. And if I use Gauss quadrature, then I can say something about the remainder term. So the integral is just the sum ai f of ti, and either I make it 0 to n or 1 to n. So 0 means really that one of the nodes are fixed. Maybe t naught is a fixed node. So the question is how to compute these. Everything will revolve around computing these coefficients ai and ti. And there are several ways of doing this, but one way is looking at the tridiagonal matrix C1 up to CK, eta 1, eta k minus 1. And looking at this tridiagonal matrix, and as it turns out, that the eigenvalues of JK are equal to the TI. That is, all we need to do is compute eigenvalues of a tridiagonal matrix, and then we have all the information that we need. And if I include a T naught here, then that's, as I said, an inverse eigenvalue problem. That means I fix one of the eigenvalues of this matrix, and then I recompute the matrix. That's a trivial calculation to make. And these C's and eta's come about from orthogonal polynomials. Which satisfy this three-term recurrence relationship. So if we can so our problem is if we want to evaluate this sum here, is to somehow compute these coefficients of the orthogonal polynomials, and then that would give us the TIs. Oh, these betas are eta's, huh? Okay. Okay, and as I pointed out, we could really write U transpose F of A. U is going to be approximated by E1 transpose, let's say, JK of F of JK. F of JK, or JK plus 1 bar indeed, times E1. Okay, so this says take the analytic function, evaluate it in this tridiagonal matrix, and then just take this quadratic form. And this is relatively easy to compute. So if f is like is just equal to a to the minus second power, then this would be jk plus 1 to to the minus second power. So you just have to evaluate this quadratic form. So that's really.
What does the bar mean?
Oh, the bar meant when I took a T naught, when I fixed one of the points. So, JK plus one bar fix T naught, one of the nodes. Now, so everything is going to revolve about, at this point, how to compute this tridiagonal matrix. And there, I'll just point out to two methods that are possible. One is, look at a matrix H, which looks like the following. It's a Hankel matrix. Uh, 2k minus 2. All right, so look at this k by k Hankel matrix. Look at its Kolesky factorization. I won't do the algebra that's required for this next point. And remember, Kolesky factorization looks like this, R11 up to R kk, R1. Dot, dot, dot. And here's the remarkable thing, that the coefficients Cj and eta j squared, they're functions of Rj, j, and Rj, j plus 1. Maybe this is a little... they're really a function of more of these elements. But the important thing to, and this is given elsewhere, of course, that the important thing to note is that if we can compute just these two diagonals of this Kolesky factorization of the Hankel matrix, then we have enough information to compute the Xs and the Etas. And this will come up in a different context. It's not done very often. And remember, these mu j's really came about from, well, various ways we could say, R naught a to the jth power R naught. So you really don't want to compute these moments. But had you computed the moments, or had they been moments in another context, given the moments, you can, by looking at this Kolesky factorization, then you can compute you can compute these coefficients. And this, of course, would be O of n k cubed operations. There's another algorithm, a simpler algorithm, which is O of k squared operations. I won't go through that. But the names, they're wonderful names associated with it. One is Chebyshev, and the other is Markov. They both were connected with developing algorithms for computing from the moments going to the orthogonal polynomials. Okay, so there is an O of n squared operation, and I'll say something about that later. Okay, so now that's one method, but that's not the method that we most often use. And the method we use most frequently, I guess, is associated with Lanchos, Cornelius Lanchos, Levy, Steelcheese. I never get this name right. No, well. Huh? Okay. Okay. So, many of you may have heard of Lanchos. I'll say a word or two about him. Who was Levy? Well, that was Lanchos' real name. And Lanchos was born in Hungary. And at that time, lots of people who were Jewish changed their names to names like to Lanchos, Feketa, Lax. Those names were somewhat different originally. And I think the algorithm, isn't there a transposition here? huh? I never get this name right, I'm embarrassed to say. So Lanchos must surely have been aware of the algorithm of steel cheese. He left Hungary in the 20s. There was an Admiral Horthy, who was a fascist admiral. And so he left, and he went to Germany. And he was there for a while, and he thought it was pretty hot there. So he went to the United States, where he lived in the 30s and 40s. He claimed he was always one step ahead of the next dictator. And then he was at Purdue, and from was at Purdue, what we call the Lanchos algorithm today, was while he was working at while he was at Boeing and associated with the National Bureau of Standards. And then during the McCarthy era, he thought things were getting pretty bad in the United States, so he moved to Ireland, where it's peaceful. Actually to Dublin. And he was a marvelous writer and developed many of the ideas that we currently use in modern numerical analysis. At any rate, the idea is, well, here we have this. This is given in a scalar. We can write it in terms of matrices. Pj plus 1 of A is equal to A minus Cj plus 1 I. We can generate these matrix polynomials. Let me multiply this now by a vector. Let's see how I did this. A vector u, and let me define wj as being equal to the polynomial of degree j in the matrix A times u, and we see we have a sort of a three-term recurrence relationship. And then what we do, this is the classical thing in orthogonal polynomials, we insist that wj transpose wj plus 1 is equal to 0, and wj plus 1 transpose wj minus 1 is equal to 0. So we use an induction proof and then force these two conditions to be satisfied. And just as in ordinary development of orthogonal polynomials, this implies that wj plus 1 transpose wr is equal to 0 for r less than j minus 1. So it's very easy to do these induction proofs. Now, let's see, just to be complete, say that Cj plus 1 is this inner product Wj Awj over the inner product of Wj Wj, and the eta j squared is, now you can, after a little manipulation, you can see it's the length squared of wj over the length squared of wj minus 1. And so you can see this is always greater than or equal to 0. And that's why I can say that that's non-negative. OK, well, that's the Lanchos algorithm is given in a very simple way. We generate a sequence of vectors, wj. W naught is the initial vector u, and we use this recurrence relationship, computing these inner products, and that gives us exactly the cj's and the eta j squares that we want. Well, look, as I said, by induction, I prove these vectors are zero. Therefore, the inner product of wj, wk, if that's equal to zero, and that's equal to also pj of a the inner product of pk of a and times u, excuse me, times u. And once we use the orthogonal decomposition for the matrix A, this would be just equal pj, the inner product pj of lambda q transpose u pk lambda q transpose u. And that's just our integral pj of lambda pk of lambda dw of lambda. And that's equal to zero. So all we've done is develop another way of constructing the orthogonal polynomials. And you can see it's a very straightforward algorithm. There are, of course, many subtleties here. And Chris Page here is one of the great experts on that subject. But the interesting thing is, we don't actually compute the powers of the matrix. We compute this sequence, and every new vector just depends upon the previous two vectors in the way that we've written it here. So if we had computed moments directly, as I've stated here, then you can see there's this whole business of taking powers, computing a Krylov sequence. It would take a large number of vectors. But if you use this very simple relationship here, it's relatively straightforward to compute the vectors. Okay, so now we sort of have the basis for some of the for solving some of the problems that I've discussed earlier. And let me just go through that in part. So recall I mentioned computing estimates of mu minus 2. So mu minus 2 is R transpose, the residual vector, A to the minus 2 R. Okay. And here's the idea. And let's assume that we'll normalize the vector R. We'll just multiply it by a constant and fix it up so it's well. So the first step is compute JK plus 1 bar. That's our tridiagonal matrix with C1. Here's our CK plus 1 bar, A to 1, and so forth. And again, this element here is chosen so that either we have used a lower bound or an upper bound of the largest and smallest eigenvalue. And then one computes E1 transpose jk plus 1 bar to the minus second e1. So it's relatively straightforward and easy to do this calculation. And of course, the larger k is, the better the bound. And indeed, if one goes to jn, then you do have the exact value of the error. Okay, now a second problem I discussed. Maybe I'll just go into. Was fixing the length of the solution. So, as I mentioned, very often in least squares problems and truss region problems, then one has a prescribed value of the length of the solution. And so this is works in a fairly straightforward way. You begin the Lanczos process with U equals B. Then you construct the matrix JK plus 1 bar. Next, one solves this equation. And you can differentiate this equation with respect to mu. And one shouldn't apply Newton's method. Oh, thanks. One shouldn't apply Newton's method directly on this function. There's some numerical devices one has to use. But you see, one determines an upper bound and a lower bound on the mu star. And eventually, one converges or gets enough accuracy to stop the iteration process. Most often, this parameter alpha is not known to 100 significant places you know, one, whether it's 1 or 1.02 or 0.97, one doesn't really worry about that. But within a few iterations, one can get a very good estimate of solving for the Lagrange multiplier. Once you're given the Lagrange multiplier, of course, then you have to solve the problem A plus mu I x equals B. Now, with the Lanczos vectors themselves, if one has saved those vectors, then you can actually then get an approximation to the solution. So there's sort of like a free lunch effect here. Not only can you solve for the Lagrange multiplier during the computation itself, but once you've solved for that multiplier, then you have enough information to get a good approximation to the solution itself. Now, and there are other, thank you so much. I'll just do this one other one. Maybe you can. Another I pointed out you may want to solve for diagonal elements of the inverse. And then here you can just apply the Lanczos with U equals EJ, go through some steps. I actually have some numerical values. Maybe I'll give those later. And if you just do this whole thing analytically, here's an expression for the diagonal elements of the inverse of a matrix. So one can actually do that calculation here. This is just doing two steps of the Lanczos algorithm, doing some manipulations. But if you ever need an expression for diagonal elements of the inverse, these are upper and lower bounds for such expressions. And then I mentioned, of course, you can, by working with the bilinear forms, you can get the elements of the JK element, the JK element of the inverse. Let's see, I think I have an example. No, that's not in these. Okay. Well, there are a lot of applications to this whole idea, and I'd like to now discuss an application that's much more elaborate than what I've talked about up to now. And can I have lights again? Thanks. So I will now talk about a favorite topic, and it's associated with, now let's see, I was told, oh, I have this one. With Tikhonov regularization. Okay. And I should have an H here. Okay. So Tikhonov was a Russian mathematician who was in Moscow, and he was very interested in the problem of solving ill-posed problems. And indeed, one time I gave a lecture on orthogonal methods for solving least squares problem, and at the end of it, he sort of denounced me because I think he had a great he had another argument to make. At any rate, for least squares problems, we want to minimize B minus AX, okay. And what often one does to get a smoother solution is to minimize the norm of B minus AX squared plus some parameter here, alpha times the norm X squared. And you want to make this into a minimum. Okay, so this is the classical Tikhonov regularization problem, and the big problem is choosing alpha. And people have proposed all kinds of things. Most often the proposal is to just use something sort of almost random. But it would be nice to have a way of computing alpha. And there's a lot of discussion about that. Once you choose alpha, then you solve this new problem. So it's a least squares, if you state it in this fashion, it's a least squares problem where you've shifted the diagonal elements of A transpose A. That means the singular values of the matrix A transpose A are shifted, and the condition number of A transpose A plus alpha I is always less than the condition number A transpose A. So the question is how to choose this, as I say, and there have been lots of different methods that have been proposed in connection with solving ill-posed equations. Now, one of the people who's made done a lot of work on solving ill-posed problems in a statistical context is Grace Wabba, and she's at the University of Wisconsin, and she's made has had various ideas, and she extended an idea that's well known, and it's called generalized cross-validation. Okay, so it's GCV. And this has various optimal properties from a statistical point of view. And the idea is to somehow, from the data itself, to be able to determine this parameter alpha. And the question is, how can one do that? So here's the idea. I'll write A sub I as the data matrix, only we'll skip the ith observation. Okay. And likewise, B sub I is equal to the vector with the ith observation skipped. And sometimes I put a slash through there, maybe that's even better, meaning I've dropped the ith observation in the data. And then from this data, we can actually compute the least square solution. In other words, we could have AI transpose AI plus alpha I, and then XI of alpha, I'll put it this way, is equal to A transpose BI. Okay? So this is our least square solution with the ith observation dropped. And then what we're going to do is look at the residual for BI minus AI transpose XI. Okay? So we drop the ith observation, compute the least square solution for a fixed alpha, look at the residual. Where's that? No. Here or here? No, because I'm just going to stick it. In other words, I drop the first observation. I do the fitting on m minus 1 pieces of data, get the fit, stick it back into the first equation. It's to see, it's sort of like a consistency check. Okay. So I don't want a capital A, I want a little a. Okay. So sticking it back. One row at a time. So that means if I have 100 observations, I have to do 100 of these least squares problem. And so then the idea is find alpha, minimize over all alpha, the norm of R of alpha. R of alpha means this whole entire vector in the 2 norm. Okay. So that's the basic idea. And how do we do that? Okay. So it seems to imply that we have to do, remember, this is I equals 1, 2, up to m. It seems to imply that we have to do m such least squares fits. But let's look at what we have. Remember, AI transpose AI is just A transpose A minus AI AI transpose. In other words, it's a rank one change from the original data matrix. Every one of these matrices, these AI transpose AI, is really just a rank one change from the original matrix A transpose A. And likewise, AI transpose BI is just A transpose B minus the element BI times the vector AI. Okay? So that's been changed by that amount. And then, yep. Yeah, thanks a lot. For posterity, I guess, yeah. Okay. Now, one of the formulas that's discovered over and over and over again is called the Sherman-Morrison formula. All right. Well, he's still alive, maybe that. How about, does anybody know of M.S. Bartlett? How would you like Fredholm? You can actually trace it to Fredholm. If you read it deeply enough. Okay. At any rate, all these guys came up with and how about Mike Powell? You know, the Fletcher-Powell algorithm really depends upon this formula. How about the Kalman filter? It depends upon this formula. So it's something that's discovered over and over again. And we can attribute a lot of people to it. And what does it say? All right. So this inverse, AI, can you see I transpose AI plus alpha I inverse, okay, is just going to be equal to, so we just make use of all these formulas I've written down, A transpose A plus alpha I inverse plus A transpose A plus alpha I inverse AI, AI transpose. It's a rank one change to all divided by 1 minus AI transpose A transpose A plus alpha I inverse AI. Okay, so we have a nice expression here. It involves the inverse of the original matrix when we change it by the matrix of rank 1 plus some other stuff. And out of all this, the residual turns out to be a very simple quantity. Ri of alpha is just Bi minus A transpose A plus alpha I inverse A transpose B over 1 minus AI transpose. I'm getting too much with the formulas, so maybe I should. Okay. So this formula really, I mean, saves our whole computational effort so that when we look at the length of the residual vector square, it's just equal to the norm of D inverse, I'll tell you what that is, I minus A transpose A plus A, excuse me. It's A times A transpose A plus alpha I inverse A transpose times B squared. Okay. So look, This is the simplification, so-called simplification. So you have I minus this expression. This is a projection matrix, close to a projection matrix. If alpha equals 0, this is just the projection matrix. And this matrix D is a diagonal matrix, which makes everything equal to, the diagonal elements of this matrix equal to 1. So I'm going to, this is greater than or equal to the Frobenius norm of D inverse. No. What do I want? The Frobenius norm, okay, times this expression, I minus dot, 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 times B squared. Okay. And this quantity here is called the general cross-validation function. So G CV of alpha. I'll put a square on it. Now, maybe it's manipulated a little further. I won't go onto all the things. But what one really needs to do is evaluate. No, greater than. It's because I'm going to divide. Here I have the Frobenius norm of this thing here. So this would be 1 over, right? Okay. So, and finally, to evaluate this, we need to compute this quantity. This is turns out to be V. We need to compute A transpose A plus alpha I minus 1 B squared over the trace of A transpose A plus alpha I inverse. That's what it, this is, by computing this, we can get the generalized cross-validation function. Now, the numerator here falls, so given an alpha, the numerator is very easy to calculate. So this we can use by our moment stuff. Okay, so if this is just a quadratic form that I have in the numerator. What about this? How do we compute the trace of the inverse of a matrix? And that's a very difficult computation to make. And several years ago, I have to admit to my faults, I refereed a paper where a guy used a Monte Carlo method for evaluating. And I thought that was really ridiculous. But it turns out it's a terrific idea. And it's, let me just mention the following. So if you have, let's say you have a matrix B and it's symmetric, well, we'll make it in positive definite. Okay. And if you evaluate, take a random vector, U, transpose B, U. All right, so this is a vector now, although I've, and it's a random variable. And this variable takes on the value, the probability that UI equals a half, 1 plus 1 is equal to a half, and the probability of UI, the ith component, equals minus 1 is equal to a half. So the expected value of this quantity is equal to 0, and we're going to make all these elements independent of one another. So they'll be just have this uniform distribution. Everything is independent, and we'll take the expected value of this. Okay, and then this is just the sum, bii time. That's it. Because these are independent, the expected value of the ui's are all equal to 0. The expected value of the ui squared is equal to 1. So we really get just the trace of the matrix. So the expected value, if we did another experiment where we took u transpose times a transpose a plus alpha I inverse u, and we took the expected value of that, that would be equal to the trace of a transpose a plus alpha I to the minus 1. So the way we approximate the inverse, the trace of the inverse here, is by Monte Carlo. So now, I've often said that you shouldn't use Monte Carlo unless you really have a statistical problem. I don't know if this is really a statistical problem. It's used everywhere in so many different parts of science, Monte Carlo methods. But it really works here. So all I can tell you, I mean, I don't have any great proof that it works except in the numerical experiments. So what do we do? Well, what would be the idea? You would generate this vector with plus ones and minus ones. Okay. Then you would use this mechanism, the Lanczos algorithm, on the matrix A transpose A. Then you would sort of, and your alpha would be fixed. And then you would estimate this quantity here, go through k steps. Now, you know, it doesn't hit all the statistical theory correctly. You're getting upper and lower bounds and so forth. But it really does give you extremely good estimates of the cross-validation parameter. Yeah? It does. It could be normal. This minimizes the variance, as a matter of fact. But it doesn't have to be. It could be normal. It could be anything, just so long the expected value is equal to 0 and the elements are independent of one another. And then you can get the solution. No. Well, of this, what do? You see, you begin with the vector u, and you do use this mechanism that I have used. You use the Lanczos algorithm with your initial u as your initial vector. Apply to, say, a transpose a plus alpha I, if you want. You don't actually, alpha is extraneous parameter. But you apply it to this, and then you sort of estimate this quantity in here, an upper and lower bound when it's, you know, so it's there's some subtle issues in probability that you would have to address, and we've looked at most of those things. But so you could take several of this. So you generate one u, and then another u, and so forth. Okay. The trouble is, of course, well, not the trouble. Every time you use this for another u, it could be a long computation. Well, we found the optimal number of vectors here is equal to 1. So we actually just do it with, because the whole thing is, it's all a little flaky. I mean, you know, how most statistics is, you know. It works if it hits you in the eye, or, you know, it's called the monocular effect. It hits you in, that's what John Tukey used to say, hits you in the eye. So, And this cross-validation function isn't a nice, smooth, convex function. It more or less gets you in the right ballpark, but it has some local minima. So when it works well, but don't count your life on it either. So that's another point. At any rate, it's a combination of using the idea behind moments and using a little Monte Carlo methods, and it really works quite nicely. And we have improved estimates. If I have time, I'll talk about those. But we have better ways. We get even improved variations on our estimates. And that then generally provides a cross-validation parameter. And given the cross-validation parameter, then you're able to get a good estimate of the least squares solution. Okay, I'll show you. Well, I have a curve, but perhaps it's not best thing to do. I'll show you some, refer to some other stuff later. I'm going to switch now to a slightly different idea. By the way, for those of you who like problems, maybe I should just say, this whole Monte Carlo idea is the following. Here's a problem that I'll give you. Estimate the determinant of a matrix A, actually, log determinant, using moment calculation. And Monte Carlo. So we have using these same ideas I've described here, if you need to estimate the determinant of a very large matrix, you could do these same ideas. And it's been very effective for quantum chromodynamic calculations. In those problems, people have very large determinants that they need to evaluate. And these ideas that I've expressed here, using the Lanczos algorithm, they're able to get good estimates of the determinant matrix. Yeah? Yes. Oh, there. For instance, in my paper with Bai and Fahey, we estimate the sum of k eigenvalues in a certain interval, and by similar stochastic ideas, practically, yeah, an approximation. So it's one layer of approximation upon another. Well, let's see, who gave the talk? Our friend from Livermore. The amount of approximations that physicists made, I'm just sort of astounded that your numbers mean anything at the end of your calculation. But in your modeling, I mean, that's what happens in physics all the time. There's one from one layer to another layer to another layer. And so there's several layers of approximation that go on here. At any rate, this does seem to be an effective way for doing estimates of the determinant. Okay, so let me just finish up by maybe giving a preview of one of the things I want to talk about next time. And that's what's called modified moments. Modified moments. And there are several people who have worked on this. One person who's noted is Walter Gauchy. And there are Sack and Donovan have also done work in this. And there are, I should say, chemists who have also found this technique of great use. So what we've talked about so far, of course, is working with moments, mu k, is equal to the integral lambda k. He's mu k. Now, sometimes, let's say we might go from W of lambda might be replaced by W bar of lambda by a new weight function. And perhaps they don't differ very much. And we know that the integral of pj of lambda, pk of lambda, dw of lambda equals 0 when j is not equal to k. So the question is, if we have these polynomials with respect to this measure, and we know the recurrence relationship, can we now find sort of we want to find a new set of polynomials, pi j of lambda, pi k of lambda, dw bar of lambda. Okay, that's equal to 0 for j not equal to k. Using, well, there are two sets of quantities we might use. We might use the integral of, let's say, pj of lambda dw bar of lambda. I'll call that mu k. So this is a modified moment. Okay. So the p's are what I have. I get a new weight function w bar. Okay. Using that, with these quantities mu k, can I then calculate the recurrence relationship for the pi's? So we really want a new recurrence relationship, or we might be given the quantity, we might have a gramium, that is, we might have a matrix where GRS is the integral of PR of lambda, PS of lambda, dW bar of lambda. We might have this information. Given this matrix G, a gramian, can we then construct the recurrence relationship for these pi's? Okay. And I'll talk about that next time along with other things. Why would you want to do that? I'll give you two examples. One is, suppose you orthogonal polynomials are often used with respect to data fitting. So you assume you have m pieces of data. First you fit a linear fit, quadratic, and so forth. Now what do you do if you get one more piece of data? Then how do you update your orthogonal polynomials? Or you want to drop a piece of information, how do you update your orthogonal polynomials? As well as, by the way, computing new quadrature formulas is another place. And another place I'll mention are on numerical iterative methods where you need parameters of the estimate of the smallest and largest eigenvalue, and you have a set of orthogonal polynomials, say Chebyshev polynomials, on some interval, and then you want to get some further information about the eigenvalues, the operator, using these ideas of modified moments, you can do so. So that, along with moments in the complex plane, some joint work with Jim Vera and Payman Mildenfarr, I'll mention in my next lecture, which will be on Thursday of this week. So thank you. That's right.
What you're really interested in is the dependence on alpha. And so what do you do? Take several different values of alpha?
Oh, no. This is supposed to provide the optimal alpha. I mean, you can write down the dependence, I mean, mathematically. But the whole point is, in a generalized cross-validation or in Tikhonov regularization, to choose an optimal parameter, alpha. And this is supposed to produce that optimal alpha.
You showed us how to get the value of this trace.
Yes.
Given alpha.
Yes, and then you evaluate it for several alpha. You have to minimize this generalized cross-validation.
So you showed us how to get it for a particular alpha. It's right under the middle board.
Okay, so what would I have to do here? So in the numerator, you see, the Lanczos method, if I use the Lanczos method for A transpose A, it's the same Lanczos method if I shift it by alpha. And in a similar way, like I need the trace of A transpose A, so I shift it for a certain alpha. So what I do is I have a curve for various alphas. You're right. I get a curve, and then I choose that point on the curve which minimizes the curve. And that's the so this, as soon as I can get these estimates here, and I can then evaluate this quantity for various alphas, I can evaluate this for various alphas, I draw a curve, I look for the minimum of that curve, and that's the one that I choose as my cross-validation parameter.
I see.
Well, yeah, but you can use, of course, mathematically or statistically, you should use a lot of U's. But we found that you got a good enough. You know, as I said, the whole thing is a little airy, scary anyway, but like most statistics. So at any rate, you know, you just you choose a parameter alpha, and you could stick with one u, and then that would be sufficient. Yeah, it isn't sufficient. You can use a lot of u's if you want to, of course. That increases your computation. But computing, if somebody told you that you needed to compute this quantity for a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix for different alphas, how would you do it? Well, one way that people have done in the past is they compute the eigenvalues, let's say of A transpose A, and then just see how things shift with the eigenvalues. Well, so if you had a big matrix, it would take a lot of calculation. So this kind of technique is used by people in weather prediction and all kinds of other places where you have big, big data sets which are sparse. Now, in the small case, then people just use the singular value decomposition and diagonalize things, and they can do it, you know, really in a rigorous way for getting the cross-validation function. So the name of the game in, you know, modern numerical linear algebra is big matrices, and their structure, sometimes they're sparse, but big is beautiful, you know, that sort of thing. Or an estimate. That's why I call it an estimate. It's not truly a bound. It's sort of a ballpark estimate. Yeah.
But in fact, you've got a ballpark estimate of the minimization of a lower bound.
Yes. Yeah. The Monte Carlo stuff? No. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't remember. It was a French guy, and I refereed his paper, and I thought, oh, this is sort of a stupid idea. But then, like so often, when you need it, you find out it's extremely useful. And in our papers, of course, we acknowledge his work. It appeared in Numerische Mathematique. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be so blunt and say what. I want to make, if there are any students in the audience or young people, how often people make mistakes and sort of make bad judgments, and hopefully you can correct them. So you're in a position that you can correct them from time to time, but very often people do make mistakes, and I've learned that you should occasionally be modest in your thoughts. And that, of course, also as an older person, you have a right to make mistakes too. Thank you.